Welcome to Create Your Bliss with Nika Annan, conversations with people passionately engaged in creating their life's work. Today we are really wonderfully lucky to be speaking with Robinette Kennedy, PhD. She is a clinical anthropologist and shamanistic practitioner. Her work brings to life a ritual practice embodied by the sacred art of prehistoric Crete, where Robinette has lived off and on and conducted research since 1975. She is the first social scientist to document the powerful role of women's friendships in trance culture, in a traditional culture. Her book in progress is Shamanistic Poses from Prehistoric Crete. So I would like to welcome Robinette Kennedy. And so how did you get into exploring all of this?
Well, good morning, Nika. I would love to tell you that story. When you hear the story, you know that it was. There's nothing about it that was deliberate, consciously. I grew up in a very, very small rural town in South Georgia, and I went to an infinitesimally small grammar school and high school. There were 42 people in my graduating class, and I never learned about things that people in larger cities learned about, one of which was Greek mythology and history, world history. We didn't do very much past, like, the Civil War. I was aware that there was a country named Greece, but the first encounter that I had with anything to do with Greece was when I went to college and at a university where there were more people in my dorm than in my hometown. And so there's a street there with all of these Greek letters on all of these houses, and I realized that those were fraternities and sororities. And that was when I learned the Greek alphabet, when I was briefly involved with a sorority. So I never read much of Greek mythology. My major was in journalism and a minor in political science, and I also was never very interested in alternative, not Christianity religions. I became briefly interested in Buddhism because of Alexandra David Neal's book about her adventures there, but
it's a fabulous book. Yes,
I never practiced any other thing like that. I didn't have any interest in that, and so as I began to develop my academic career. And by the way, I'm an independent scholar. I've never worked at a university or anything like that. As I began to pursue humanistic psychology, which is what my PhD is in, right before I started graduate school, I went to Europe with a friend of mine, and we went to Greece. And again, I was not interested in the mythological or the religious aspects of that country at all. Came back to the States and got a master's and got a PhD. And came back to the States and decided to look for a way to study women's friendships, because in my master's program, I discovered that in the social sciences at that time, all of the studies that had been done about friendship were on usually male college students. And if it weren't male college students, it was men's friendships in general. And the prevailing view was that women and children in traditional cultures, certainly not in the United States, but in traditional cultures, that women and children were incapable of forming strong, enduring, rich friendship bonds, and I found that very curious. I was very interested in the relationship between social networks and mental health issues, and so as I began to pursue the notion that I was going to get a PhD, and I wanted to study that topic, I realized that I had to find a culture where everybody spoke the same language, had the same religious orientation and customs. All of those things must be homogenous so that I wouldn't, that I would be able to rule out any kind of cultural or religious belief system factors. And so I decided to move to Spain because I spoke enough Spanish to be able to pull off what I thought was going to be my field work there. And it was a very dangerous situation politically. Franco's government, he was dying, and they were about to be on the verge of a civil war. The situation for me as an American woman in her 20s, her mid-20s, was not, several things happened where I realized I was not safe there, so I didn't know where to go next. I used a very scientific method to decide about that. I called my astrologer.
There and you go. Good for you. and where it led you.
And so she did astrocartography, which is to find out where this, where a given person's birth date and year, you know, where that person would be most congenial on the planet. And she said, have you ever been to the Greek island of Crete? And I said, no, I haven't. I've been to other Greek islands, but I've never been to the Greek island of Crete. And she said, well, that is the place on the planet where it is, you are most likely to thrive. So my partner was able to join me in doing this, and we, with her 9-year-old daughter, packed up and moved to Crete.
Oh, wow.
So, sight unseen. And so I lived there for almost 3 years, and I learned Greek, and I, such as it is, and I lived in a small village with about 400 doors, they call it, where I began to do everything I could to assimilate myself into behaving as if I was ethical Greek woman in her 20s. And so eventually people began to trust me enough to take me into their confidence, and I began to be able to learn about the nature of women's network networks of power in a very traditional Greek village. I was the first non-Greek person to live there, and I began to discover that the reason that male anthropologists and other social scientists had never uncovered the incredible networks of women in those situations was because they were hidden from the patriarchy on purpose. And they were hidden from the patriarchy on purpose because women's resources were considered the property of their family of origin, their marital family, their husband, their in-laws, etc. And so for a woman to have a relationship that she freely chose, that's not based on any kind of patriarchal structure, was taking away resources from how life was supposed to be in a Greek village. So I found out that women were loaning each other money for abortions, from getting pregnant, from having affairs. I found out that they were standing in for each other when the other one was ill. They would bring food to the back door and give it to the family to entertain their in-laws with, so that they wouldn't look like they were weak, etc. And so after I got going on that project, the same astrologer that I had consulted about moving to Crete came to see us, and she said, Robinette, you, and I still have the piece of paper that I wrote this on, she said, Robinette, you will be known for your work, your research on Crete, but it will have nothing to do with what you are currently working on, it will have to do with the ancient religion of Crete. And I said, you know, Phyllis, you are always on the button about everything that I've ever known for you to be telling me about, but I have absolutely no interest. I never went to the museum. I mean, I went in the museums, but maybe two times. But I was totally not interested in the ancient culture of Crete in any way. I completed my field work. I came back to the States, and that was in 77. I moved to Santa Fe, New Mexico, which is when and where Felicitas Goodman, who is the first person to document the use of ritual poses in ancient shamanic cultures, and I'll get back to that in a moment. Ironically, I moved to Santa Fe and lived there about a year and a half before moving back to Atlanta, Georgia, which is where I had started off from when I went to graduate school. So I came back to Atlanta, and I finished my dissertation. I appointed myself a clinical anthropologist, which is another interesting story. I would then went into private practice, and so here we are, 1990, and I'm very happily have a fascinating career. I continue to go back to Crete. I have a goddaughter there. I have dear friends there. And one day in August 1990, my brother called me and told me that this land that our family holds very dear in South Georgia, which is along one of the only wild and scenic rivers designated by Congress in the Southeast.
Wow.
Our land, next door to our land, which we had literally a little shack there that my father made of found materials in the 50s. Next door to the swamp house, we call it, someone had bought 800 acres of land, and they were in the process of bulldozing roads and digging holes for septic tanks, the effluents of which would, of course, go into the river.
Right.
So my brother, who lived nearby, had done everything he could think of. He had hired an attorney. He and a neighbor had filed injunctions. They had... he had called everybody he could think of, and he was now calling me to ask me if I knew of anybody who had connections with the EPA or the EPD. I hired a hydrological engineer to help guide us, and everything we tried was not working, and we were berserk. And so my partner at the time came to me, and she said, I have found this magazine article, which was in Shaman's Drum, about these poses that may be used for divination. And at that moment, I was not interested in poses that might be used for divination. I wasn't interested in divination. I wasn't, you know, none of that. But the article, which was about Felicitas Goodman's work, the article, something about it, struck me, and my partner said, you know, maybe we could do this pose and we could ask what can be done to save the land and stop this horrible thing that's happening. And so I called a friend of mine who's a psychologist, and I asked her what she was going to be doing that night, because I needed her to come over and spot me, like, you know, if I was going to do acid or something, and she'd have
right,
to call
right, to be sure, take care of me.
If I was going to lose my mind, and my partner was going to rattle. And so Paula came over, and we sat on the floor, and I sat in a position that a shaman in Africa in the photograph showed that he uses when he does divining. And so my partner rattled for about 15 or 20 minutes, and in that time, with my eyes closed, I had this vision, and to my knowledge, except for experiences earlier 10 or 12 years earlier that I had had with marijuana or peyote or anything like that. I had never had a consciously induced shamanic vision. I'd never had that experience. And my vision, when I tell you, sounds very simple, but it changed my life because of what happened after the vision, which is another one of my favorite topics, that we don't just have the vision. We have to integrate the vision. We have to do something with the vision. So my vision was that I was on the opposite side of the river, and I was up in, I was looking down from up in the air at the top of the little shack and the scene around the little shack, and I could hear birds singing, and I could hear the breeze and the dry leaves, early fall, and there was this peaceful air about the whole situation that somehow overtook me, and I felt this enormous calm and peace and reassurance, and I knew that everything was going to be all right and that nothing was going to happen to the land of the swamp. So I immediately went to the phone and I called my brother, and he was a very conservative person. I called my brother and I said, "Brett, you won't believe it, but I sat on the floor in this position and boy rattled, and I had this vision, and everything's going to be fine." And my brother, I hope I can say this on the radio, my brother said, "Bullshit," and said, "You know, here I am trying to do all these things, and you call me and tell me this mess. This doesn't help.
Just don't worry about it."
Exactly. So that was on a Wednesday, and on Sunday morning, no, on Friday afternoon, my brother was at home. He had gotten off work early, and he was at his farm, which is very close to the river, and this man drove up in a federal U.S. truck, government truck, and he got out of the truck, and he said, "Are you the person that, are you Mr. Kennedy?" And Brett said, "Yes," and he said, "I have been told to come and investigate your farm for being in violation of the federal wetlands protection law." And Brett said, "Please inspect my farm, but there are no violations. But after you inspect this farm, I would like to take you down to the river and show you somewhere that really is violating the Wetlands Protection Act." And someone had reported Brett as retaliation for his trying to stop the activity at the development, which was going to be a trailer park. So the man went down to the river with Brett. When he saw what was happening there, he immediately got on the radio and filed a stop work order, and that was on Friday afternoon. And the man said, "This is unbelievably illegal. It cannot happen. It will never happen. This development will never happen." Sunday morning, 2 days later, a law enforcement official, well, he's dead now, the sheriff of our county, was out on the highway where people were going to go to the auction to buy the land, and the sheriff stopped every car. He leaned in to the driver and said, "Just want to make sure you have directions." And on the other side of the car, my brother leaned in and offered a pamphlet to everybody, a flyer to everybody that came to the auction, and said, the pamphlet said, "This is under federal injunction. You will probably never be able to build or put a trailer on this land. So we just want you to know that before you go to the auction." Not one car turned into the gate to go to the auction. And 2 weeks later, a total stranger came and bought the land, 800 acres, and it is exactly in the same condition it was in 1990 today.
Oh, how powerful.
So who knows why and how, and, you know, lots of people could say that's just a coincidence. But in my life, the way I feel about that land and the way I feel about that river, it got my attention. And I tracked down the anthropologist who had the article was about, who was Felicitas Goodman, and I found out that she did workshops, and I flew to D.C. to go to the next workshop she had. It turned out that everybody in the workshop, except for about three people, went off campus where the workshop was being held for lunch. Felicitas and I fell into conversations, and it was like a match made in heaven. It was like, where have you been all my life? So we had these conversations about the relationship in of how we care for the land and what is happening in our consciousness in Western culture, which were two of our most favorite topics. And I got a copy of her book that had just come out about her research on poses that were used. We don't really know how, but based on archaeological evidence, we know a lot more than we did in 1990, but the poses that she had identified were based on her realizing, having read an article that said that the position of the body during a religious experience, yoga or meditation, etc., and eventually she discovered that there were poses associated with rhythm, listening to percussion, that the position of the body affects the nature, the content of the visionary experience that somebody has. And visionary, a vision, as you know, doesn't mean something that you see necessarily. It can be
right.
A kinesthetic experience where you feel something. It can be a clairvoyant experience where you just know. And that's what happened with me in the vision I had of the swamp house. I just knew. I was shown that reality, and then that reality came into being. So Felicitas began to document figurines of unusual of human beings in unusual positions of the body. And so she began to teach groups of students at Ohio State, her Ohio State students, and then neighbors and friends, without showing them a photograph. She was a scientist first and foremost, so she wanted to do it in an objective way with a scientific attitude. There's no such thing as the scientific method. There's a scientific objective attitude. And so she would not show them a photograph of the figurine so as to give away what the content of their vision should be, so people wouldn't have an expectation of, oh, I must see a bird when I do this pose.
Mm-hmm.
She would only demonstrate the pose herself and then say, I want you to sit or lie or stand in this way. Close your eyes, and I am going to rattle. And she began to ask people to write down their experiences. They would write them down, and then they would talk about them, and there would be a remarkable similarity in the content of the visions that people had. And in that way, she was able to identify, when you do the position like this, people have an experience of a bear spirit. When you do this, people have an experience of flying. When you do this, you are able to travel to the land of the ancestors, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I met Felicitas, she had just really begun to document something that she had an inkling about in 1977, but she had just begun to get to the point that she could reliably count on, if you take a group of strangers and rattle for them while they're in this position of the body, you know, there's a statistically significant chance that they will have very similar experiences. So the idea that we could, I mean, I saw yesterday that people are planning to clone the mammoth, and I thought this is kind of like what the poses are about, in that we are able to use those figurines, those positions of the body with sacred intent, with a
mm-hmm.
that with a safe atmosphere where people feel respected and everyone is treated kindly and respectfully, we're able to open a morphic field, a resonance that is like a time capsule that allows us to step back into the consciousness of a way of living in relationship with other beings, nature, and other human beings, and with the earth, and with the spirits, and with the ancestors, and with your body, and the way that you conduct your daily affairs that existed on the earth sustainably for a very long time. And so I believe that we, our only chance to change the way that we relate to the earth and to each other is to reintroduce experiences of shamanic consciousness into our daily lives in Western culture. So here I am, just, you know, I've met Felicitas and I'm going to every workshop she offers, and I began to look at her collection of photographs from around the world from between 10,000 years ago and 30,000 years ago. That number was a very important number in Felicitas Goodman's thinking, because she was totally positive that the type of society that existed indicated whether or not that society had shamanism and shamanic elements in the culture. Now, what does that mean? That means that there was no hierarchy in gatherer-hunter cultures and in horticulturalist gardening-hunter cultures. There were small groups of people, not large cities, several different characteristics like that, that in Felicitas' anthropological training were the gospel. And so the notion that there were shamanic elements in Minoan or prehistoric Crete, the first European culture, the Greek island of Crete, that idea was very, Felicitas was very skeptical about that. And so she had put down that marker of 10,000 years ago, and that, you know, is where people started to farm in certain places around the world. And Felicitas believed that when the people began to manipulate the atmosphere, the wilderness, that changed the nature of the content of their rituals. And that people, it changed the content of their daily sense of being in harmony with the earth, that they felt upset that they were having to manipulate the mother, meaning the earth, who provides everything we need. We don't need to have to go and manipulate her to grow these greens right here. We can just go out in the mountainside and gather those greens. We don't have to plant cherry trees. We can go find wild cherry trees. They're all right there. So in her mind, that also meant that people stopped experiencing shamanic consciousness. So I had this sneaky suspicion that some of that didn't seem to add up, because one, some of the poses that Felicitas had identified around the world pre 10,000 years ago, some of those poses were depicted by figurines in the museums of Crete, the first European culture. So I was I really went into this, my life work, really went into this with a very skeptical, open mind. And what I was trying to find out was how would I reconcile that contradiction. So I began to teach, friends of mine and experience once a week for years. I I experienced these poses, then I began to teach them in workshops with total strangers and then I began to teach only the poses from Crete. And I continued to go back to Crete. I began to see, this is mind-blowing to me, I began to see objects in the museums that in Crete that were 4,000, 3,000, 6,000 years old that people would have seen in Atlanta, Georgia in a workshop when I would introduce these poses, objects that I had never noticed or seen before consciously.
Right.
So 1997 is when I did the first tour that I do now on about a semi-annual, biannual, every other year.
Mm-hmm.
It's this on Crete where Felicitas came on that tour, and we had people from Europe and Greece and the States, and we went around Crete to some of the sacred sites where the poses had been found, and we experienced the poses. We performed the poses from Crete, and we saw the sacred ritual objects in the museums. And on the last day of the tour, when we sat on the steps of Knossos and everybody was going to go back to their home cities the next day, Felicitas said, there's no way on earth that this culture could have had shamanism, because this temple that we're sitting in, which is a huge place, if you haven't been to Knossos, it's huge.
Mm-hmm.
Felicitas said, this must have been built by slaves, and there must have been a hierarchy, an economic and a religious hierarchy. And she went home and she wrote a book in German that said, do not do the poses from Crete. They will make you lose power. They are dangerous.
Oh, dear.
So that and some other things that happened in my relationship with Felicitas in terms of disagreeing about some ethical things led me to tell her that I think that was, we had to have a parting of the ways, and we did. And since that time, that was 97. So it was either 97 or 98 that these two British, they do not want me to say British, these two archaeologists from Ireland and England and partly Cyprus,
mm-hmm.
contacted me and asked me if I would meet them on Crete the next time I was there and let them take me to a Bronze Age ritual site at a peak.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, a Bronze Age ritual site that they were excavating and had been excavating for like 8 years because they found out about my research. We went there, and when we got there, this very remote four-wheel drive top side of a mountain in the middle of Crete. We get there, and they said to me, where do you think we should do this? Because they had asked me if I would do a certain pose there, that they had found a figurine of a new, quote-unquote, new 4,000-year-old
right.
pose there.
New to us, right.
not exactly new age, but so they said, where do you think we should stand? And so I didn't consciously say, spirits, guide me to where we should stand. I just thought, let me see if I can see a good place where we can stand to do this. And so I said, well, we should do here. And I remembered out of the corner of my eye, I remembered Alan Peatfield and Christine Morris, his wife and co-researcher. I remember his look, glancing at her, and I thought, what? I couldn't place the glance. I didn't know what the context of the glance was. So we did that pose. I rattled for that. There were five of us there that day. I rattled for us to do, for them to do the pose, the four people to do the pose, and then my partner rattled for me to do another pose that they had asked me to do there,
mm-hmm.
and then I told them, I didn't ask them what their visions were. I told them what they wanted to know what my vision was about, and I told them, and then they told me that I had chosen out of everywhere on the side of that mountain that we could have gone, I chose the spot where they had found the center of the altar where the Bronze Age rituals had been done 4,000 years ago, and where they had found all of the figurines that they had found. And then I told them what I had seen there and what I had learned about the spot. And so since that time, both of us, it's like we both, I told Christine Morris, it's like she and I study opposite sides of the same coin, because they have documented a lot of shamanic elements of the Minoan, what we know as the Minoan culture, because in the literature of scholarly research about the most, did you know it's the most studied culture on the planet, the Minoan culture?
I did not know that.
And something about it just fascinates people. So lots of scholars have noted that in the frescoes, the images on the figurines, the frescoes, and even some about 12 gold rings that have a carved face that's about the size of your thumbnail, of these incredibly detailed and unusual scenes that everybody agrees are scenes of ecstasy. And everybody has noted these aspects to Minoan culture, but and they use words like ecstasy and trance and possession and frenzy and things like that, but nobody has ever been able to come up with an explanation for how, what was going on. So I just, not being bound by academic, let's say, guidelines, I have been able to do spiritual archaeology, which means studying the visionary angle on all of this by teaching people these poses and then documenting their experiences and finding out that they provide the 13 poses that I've identified from Crete. I've been able to place their energetic content, their visionary content of each one of the poses depicted in clay, in bronze, in paintings, in carvings, in gold rings all over the island for thousands of years. I've been able to say, now when you do this pose right here, it corresponds, its content corresponds with a certain place in a calendar of the soul, where starting with letting go, the first step in any religious spiritual path, getting ready to descend into whatever the new reality, the next phase, you can say into the underworld, you can say into letting go of what is no longer happening, facing your own death, helping other people face their death, traveling to the land of the ancestors, learning how to effectively mourn a spirit or help a spirit who is stuck between the worlds be able to go on to the afterlife, be able to start all over again with the Tree of Life pose and the center of everything, make the return journey back into the part of the year that has to do with integration, having come out of the part of the year that has to do with disintegration, the 6 months of disintegration and the 6 months of integration, going toward experiencing the kinetic energy, the holy fire pose, of the spark of life upon the waters of life, of creativity and fertility, and going on toward an amazing pose that is, the name of it is the Ilithuia, which is a word that archaeologists have been able to decipher the sounds of this word that appeared on a clay tablet at several different places and then later on, thousands of years later, was minted into a coin It means she who frees, she who releases. And she, Eliseia, was the great midwife spirit who was venerated in Minoan Crete. And there is a pose that I found that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with Eliseia.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a pose that when you do it, it evokes visions of giving birth in every possible, imaginable way. And it's especially moving that this pose lets men experience the sensations of giving birth to new worlds, to themselves, to all kinds of phenomena. And so that is a rebirth experience. There is now someone who is doing a PhD about the role of the midwife, shaman, Eliseia, she who frees, she who releases, in Minoan Crete, and then her influence spread throughout the Mediterranean, as far north as the Balkans and as far mm-hmm. west as Italy. She was a huge shamanic function, and in mythology, those of you who know Greek mythology, no one could give birth. The gods and goddesses could not give birth without the
right.
presence of Eliseia. So that's one of the most exciting things about my research, was putting all of that together. Then we go on into a pose that's depicted on some of the gold rings that appears to line up with several of the with the constellations, certain constellations. There are several poses that seem to be related to several scenes of poses that seem to be related with certain constellations that the Minoans were trying to depict in their jewelry and sometimes in their figurines. And that, the content of that constellation apparently is related to something that the purpose of those figurines had to do with certain rituals and certain times of year. There are several poses that are related with journeys to the sky world or the upper world that are very empowering. That I teach in the summertime when the height, the sunlight, the power of the sun is at its height. So that whole notion of using certain poses that embody rituals that are released when you have a respectful attitude, a safe atmosphere, the correct percussion, three beats,
right.
per second is the brain's preferred rhythm. So when you combine all of that intention and percussion, and the position of the body seems to give most people a very good chance of having an intensely profound experience that their individual brain and their individual spirits and ancestors are able to tailor-make the vision, shape the vision to be specific to the particular need that person has at that moment. So it's not exactly a one-size-fits-all spiritual
right.
practice as much as it is a reliable, effective way for people to be able to tap into their own true nature and that relationship between them and their spirit, their spirits, and their relationship with nature, so that in the way that shamanism is, they are expressing their own spirituality rather than that they are being guided by a teacher, a guru, a rabbi, a priest, etc.,
mm-hmm.
which is the one of the main elements of shamanism is that it's a spiritual democracy, there are no priests, there are no people who tell you what you should believe. There's no dogma, per se.
Right.
So, anything else?
That is fabulous. So, tell me what's coming up.
What's coming up is on the weekend of the winter solstice, I'm very excited and have been teaching with co-teaching with Gail Gulick, who lives in Asheville, North Carolina. We have been teaching a series of psychopomp workshops starting, this is the fourth of the series, the last one. We started with helping people develop their relationship with a middle world protector. So much of shamanic teachings in this country has to do with, in the popular culture, have to do with the underworld and the upper world. A lot of
right.
people don't talk about the middle world, which is this reality you and I are talking in the,
right.
in the telephone. So we help people develop their relationship with their ancestors and their own protector spirits. People are familiar with power animal spirits usually and their teacher in human form in the upper world, but we believe that it's important for people to have a strong relationship with their middle world protector before they do any kind of psychopomp work. So psychopomp meaning in Greek, the guide of the souls, the celebrant of the souls. Some people are, almost everybody is familiar with Hermes
mm-hmm.
or Mercury, in our culture, the guide of the soul. So we've been experiencing how to use the poses, certain poses and certain journeys that Gail has developed to help people who feel called to work with spirits who are stuck between the worlds, who are disembodied, spirits who are people that are facing their own death. We're all facing death, but people that are facing their death in an immediate way that I am not at this moment. So this weekend of the winter solstice, we're going to be performing a pose from Greece, from ancient Greece, that's depicted on the side of a huge funeral crater or bowl that's big enough to put a human body into, that depicts this pose that has to do with mourning the soul of the dead from this world to the land of the ancestors. That's on Saturday. And on Sunday, we'll be doing a pose excuse me, that is depicted in a constellation in the sky, that the toe of this figure that's in the picture, it's in a figurine of a pose that where both hands are up and the left hand is holding a serpent. This pose, which I call the Tree of Life pose, or Ophiuchus, which is an ancient Greek word that means the snake handler,
mm-hmm.
That's the name of the constellation. This pose, when you do this pose, one of the things that is very likely to happen is some kind of interaction with either or both a huge tree and or feeling the experience of interacting with snakes. And it's been fascinating to teach that pose and discover that because the people that would be doing the pose would not know that it had anything to do with trees or anything to do with snakes. So on
right.
Sunday,
just,
the winter solstice, we're going to be performing that pose. And I feel we are so blessed to be able to have this guidance come back into our consciousness in Western culture because we don't have to appropriate the religious, spiritual, shamanic practices of other cultures with whom we have no natural connection. And
mm-hmm.
I think it's I think it's great if somebody has a connection with, I know somebody who was in the Peace Corps, Anne Drake, who, her story is very similar to other people's of how I got associated with the poses and began to study with a Boma in Indonesia, and she became a trained shamanic practitioner that way. So I'm not saying that nobody should take on the practices of other cultures where they have a natural connection, but I think we, in this culture, we've had a tendency to just appropriate whatever we want to without realizing that there are limitations on what we should be appropriating. And one of the things that's exciting to me is to know that we can think of ourselves as Europeans, as people who have a shamanic past of our own that was on Crete, and that's very effective, that we can take up again.
That's really exciting, and I'm sure deeply integrating for people, you know, that it doesn't have
to be. It's very powerful, you know, even just to look at the photographs of these objects that are a part of that past can be very inspiring, and then to experiencing it is mind-blowing because it, like I said, it's a those 13 poses combined in a certain order help. They're like stations of the cross. They're a way to proceed through a huge ritual for a whole year, if you do them according to the 13 moons, that have many of the occasions of everyday life that we struggle with that trip us up in the middle world. Those experiences, those visionary experiences, help us heal, and in a way that's very inspiring to me.
That is so wonderful. I hate to tell you, Robinette, but we have been talking for an hour.
How did it happen?
It just flew by. So thank you so much. You can reach Robinette Kennedy at www.robinette, R-O-B-I-N-E-T-T, Kennedy, K-E-N-N-E-D-Y.com.
There's another E after the two T-T's.
Oh, did I miss? Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
R-O-B-I-N-E-T-T-E, Kennedy, K-E-N-N-E-D-Y. Thank you, because we want people to be able to find you.
Thank you.
She is based in Georgia, and we want to thank her. She also does travels to Crete, correct?
Yes. Next May, May 1st, I will be doing another spiritual archaeology tour, and Christine Morris is going to be with us for that tour. So,
wonderful. She's the archaeologist,
chairman of the Department of Classics at Trinity College in Ireland, and we're going to be exploring birth and death in Minoan Crete.
Oh, I just got chills. But we could do a whole nother hour, but we'll have to schedule that. So thank you so much again. This has been Robinette Kennedy on Nika Annan, Create Your Bliss. Thank you so much, and we will definitely have you on again.
Thank you so much, Nika. Happy holidays.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.